another edition of Critical Q&A, the show where I answer your questions based on what you've left for me in the comments sections of my Q&A videos or have sent to me by email at askchrisshelton@gmail.com. I wanted to plug, of course, my podcast. If you guys haven't checked it out, really, really please do so. Also, give it lots of shares. Give me lots of shares and likes. The likes aren't really that big of a deal. It just sort of makes me feel a little better. But the shares are important because I have been getting more subscribers lately. The channel is doing well, and I want it to do even better. And I think that there's a lot of good work here, and I would like to get those good works out there. And I really rely on you guys for positive word of mouth about what I'm doing and what I'm saying. I don't really know any other way to get to promote myself other than through you guys. So anyway, I'm asking that you do that. And of course, if you're feeling the love, you can become part of my Patreon campaign or support me through PayPal or something like that. That's also very, very helpful and actually very needed. So anyway, that being what it is, let us get into your questions. Here we go. Steve Prowitz. Chris, one element of LRH's space opera mythos that is still vague to me involves Farsec, the supposed origin planet for the Sites. What is its role in the Greater Galactic Confederation? How and why did the Sites end up working for Xenu? What is their interest in Earth? Can you please sum up briefly what you know about all this? Thanks and keep up the good work. Okay, when I was in Scientology and involved with it, I never read the reference on the LRH issue, or what we call references, on Farsec. So what I know about it is pretty much the same thing you guys are going to know about it if you have read Marty Rathman's book, Memoirs of a Scientology Warrior, which is where this information seems to have come from. I couldn't find any reference to Farsec in any other place. They all go back to referring to Marty's book. And that's fine. I'm not doubting Marty's word, because I absolutely believe that Hubbard wrote this issue laying out Farsec as the planet where the psychiatrists came from. And basically the story goes that there's some planet that existed back in the day, way, 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 way back. We're talking about trillions and trillions of years ago. That was called Farsec. That was where they grew these special brand of beings who they trained and indoctrinated to become what are now here on Earth psychologists and psychiatrists. And before there was psychology and psychiatry, they were priests and shamans. Hubbard had a lot to say about the control that priests and shamans, like tribal shamans, had, and the way that they could hypnotize people in the tribe and control and use the idea. Hubbard was really big on the idea of using a god figure to promote self worth, like that's how the priests and the shamans had power, was they were the conduits to the higher power, the higher being, and only through them could you communicate with, you know, with the gods. So therefore, that was how they had, you know, a lot of position within the tribe. So they also had techniques that they had developed, Hubbard described, like he talked about one thing in a lecture where he said that a shaman would come up to a person and yell, like just scream, rah! You know, they were trained in these like primal screams, right? And then right after the scream was over and imperceptible to anybody else, like they'd come up and go, rah! And then right after that, they would say something to the person, just a word or two. But Hubbard said, he claimed that because of the way the mind and hypnosis works, that little whispered word to the person would act like a subliminal hypnotic command, and the person would have no choice but to follow it. And so this is why you see, you know, shamans running around screaming and doing what they're doing. It looks kind of, you know, weird and crazy, but it's actually a mind control technique. Now, whether that has any truth to it or not, I have no idea. It's just something Hubbard said. But he said that these beings, these priests and shamans, were thetans, I suppose, were spiritual beings, right? That's the Scientology word for a spiritual being, is a thetan. And they live from life to life to life to life. They get a body, the body, you know, ages, grows old, dies, and the thetan goes and picks up another body, and that's the cycle that we're all trapped in. And these priests and shamans and psychs, you know, these guys are, these Barsekians, are caught in the same cycle, life after life, but they've been indoctrinated and implanted in such a way that they are working to hold back and stop any forward progress on the part of mankind. And it's all very conspiratorial, and I don't know, you know, I never read the issue on it, but this is apparently, you know, how Marty described this thing. And he said that these guys, these Farsekians, we'll call them, were so indoctrinated, were so implanted with this, that they could not respond to reason or rationale or any kind of sensible talk, and you couldn't get them out of this frame of mind, right? I guess Hubbard was saying that you couldn't audit them with Scientology techniques, right? These were people that Scientology wasn't going to work on, by, you know, if you sort of corollary that out. And they were just sort of like, it was just a knee-jerk, you know, stimulus response activity on their part to stop things and to stop forward progress on the part of people, especially, I guess, when it came to spiritual progress or, you know, becoming free from this trap of life after life after life. Now, you know, there's all kinds of questions that come to mind on this that you know, they just beg so many questions. Like, well, if the psychs are specifically targeting Scientology because it is a technology that allows a person to become free from the cycle of life after life, why didn't they target Buddhism? Because Buddhism, Hubbard even acknowledged, was the earlier tradition on which Scientology was built that also had a methodology of freeing a person from the, you know, being able to transcend from the life to life to life experience, right? So how come the psychs aren't all over the Buddhists the same way they're, you know, supposedly, according to Hubbard, all over the Scientologists, right? And this whole fantasy land only existed in Hubbard's head anyway, because the truth is that psychology and psychiatry could give a shit about Scientology. They're just not interested, right? Scientology is the one who keeps fomenting this conflict with psychiatry. Psychiatry just looks at Scientology and has from day one and gone, meh, you know, and that's it. So that's all that. Now, as far as the Galactic Confederation and all that, this is a prime example of what I was talking about before, of how there are just these inconsistencies, and Hubbard would just throw this stuff out, and it didn't all integrate into a well-meshed mythology, or cosmology, I should say. You know, this Farsekh thing was some confidential, top-secret issue that very, very few people in Scientology ever saw or read. And there's a lot of those that have never leaked, right? I've talked about the Truth Rundown, which was a whole auditing action that is done that is intense mind control. Bruce Hines made a video about it with Mark Bunker. I made my own video about it, described my own experiences with it, which is on my channel. And that's a whole rundown based on three issues that Hubbard wrote that have never seen the light of day outside of the Church of Scientology. So that's why I believe that, you know, when Marty describes the, you know, the Farsekh issue, that's sure, I believe that exists. So very few people in Scientology ever even saw this issue. But it doesn't integrate with the OT3 material particularly. In other words, I don't know, because I haven't seen the issue, but from how it was described, I didn't get that this was connected with Xenu or with the Galactic Confederation particularly. Maybe this was some sort of side venture that was going on from some other big antisocial, you know, suppressive on the whole track. You know, I'm just throwing out the Scientology's left, right, and center here, but basically what I'm saying is some big bad guy, right? You know, back in the day. I mean, Xenu, or Zemu is really what his name was. Zemu wasn't the only big bad guy, you know, in our past, right? I'm sure there were others. There would have to have been. And Hubbard never really laid out, you know, who they were by name or something, but maybe these Farsethians were, you know, a spawn of such a person. I don't know, because it didn't say, or in Marty's book. So that's, but the inconsistencies like that, the invader forces and the Markabians and the Galactic Confederation and Zemu and now the Farsethians there was a planet called Helitrobus, which had these heaven implants involving radioactive clouds and light and whatnot, right? And this was a whole place that people would be sent and implanted and made to think that they had gone to heaven. And I mean, there were so many of these things that Hubbard laid out. I mean, a lot of different stuff, and it doesn't come together well. So this is just another tale in the long series of tales that Hubbard told through the course of, you know, over the years of Scientology. A.G., you've mentioned a few times in your Q&As that errors in Preclear's case files are constantly found, and of course, correcting the errors are at the Preclear's expense, unquestionably an opportunity to siphon more money. My question is, has the church ever internally acknowledged problematic auditors by demoting or removing them because of obvious incompetence and who clearly had no business auditing other people? Oh yeah, all the time. All the time. Being an auditor in Scientology is one of the most dangerous things you can do, especially since 1996. This is when it became a real problem to be an auditor. This was 1996, was the year of the first Miscavige program of altering and really revamping Scientology in his own ideas. And this was called the Golden Age of Tech. And in 1995, Miscavige started doing investigations into technical application in Scientology at the Flag Land Base in Clearwater, Florida. And he found that there was a particular thing that auditors are supposed to look for on an e-meter that indicates the end of a Scientology process, that indicates it's done. It's called a floating needle. And on the meter, the needle is just sort of rhythmically sweeping back and forth, and it indicates that the process is done and that you've reached an end result. And Miscavige was saying that auditors were miscalling these FNs, these floating needles, and that they weren't floating needles, but they were saying that they were, and so they were not running processes properly. Now, if this was true, this would be a fairly big deal. Anyway, there were other issues as well, such as taking up, you know, when you have an e-meter in front of you and you check a question, a process with the person, it's supposed to read, it's supposed to respond on the meter in a particular way, which I'm not going to get into all the technical details right now. Yes, the e-meter video will come, okay? I really wish I'd never opened my mouth about that, but yes, it will come. I've still got research I'm doing on it. But so I'll explain all this stuff in that e-meter video when it eventually comes out. Anyway, Miscavige came down on every auditor on the planet in 1996 and demanded that they all had to retrain on the materials that they had been trained on because they had all been mistrained, he said. And he had this whole new training methodology to handle all the auditors. But there were a lot of auditors caught in the crossfire in 1996, and they were busted. And I mean busted hard. Like, there were Sea Org auditors who ended up in the galley washing dishes to this day. And there were stories of Miscavige berating auditors and really coming down hard on them because of supposed technical errors that they had made in not reading the meter properly. So becoming an auditor, suddenly you were, you know, getting ethics, you were getting conditions, you were getting busted from Post and not being allowed to audit anymore. I'm talking about high trained auditors who had audited for years, sometimes even decades. Suddenly no good. All your certificates were no good. And this became a thing from that point forward. And there were waves of auditors being busted or people getting in trouble because of this is really when 1996 is really when the videoing of auditing sessions really became a big deal. There had been camera work done prior to that, and there had been audio recording done prior to that, but this is when it really became a thing. And so lots and lots and lots of auditors in Scientology have gotten into lots and lots of trouble. And it became difficult to even, you know, find auditors or train auditors because of this big fear factor that got entered into it. Whereas before 1996, anybody could be an auditor, and anybody was considered in Scientology, anybody should be an auditor, everybody and anybody. Whether you were going to audit or not, it was expected that you were going to get trained as an auditor. This was a big deal in Scientology. And after 96, you know, it just became very problematic. I knew auditors who had been so busted in the C organization that they were on the RPF with me when I did the Rehabilitation Project Force. That's how busted you could get, is you were just segregated and sequestered, and you had to go run out all your evil intentions because you were such an evil person for daring to try to help people through auditing. So, yeah, it's and now these days, you know, there's hardly any auditors in Scientology, hardly any auditing going on at all. Miscavige has managed to just make that a profession that, you know, very few people wanted to take part in. And the time frame of becoming an auditor was extended by years. I mean, it used to be before 96, you could become an auditor in a couple months, no big deal. It was easy. And after 96, it took years just to get trained on the use of the e-meter, much less actually become an auditor. So that's all just kind of important stuff within the world of Scientology. Out in the big wide world, who cares? It's all fraud anyway. But within the world of Scientology, this was all a very big deal. So that's what I can say about that. BTC. The concept of a suppressive person is pretty clear to me, although its meaning really changed from a psychotic individual to an enemy of Scientology to anyone Miscavige wishes to defame, expel, or incarcerate. However, what is the exact definition of a degraded being? Does that only include SPs or also those WOGs who have not availed themselves of the wonder cure that only Hubbard can offer? Okay, it's a good question, actually, and the lines are gray, okay? But I dug up some definitions of a degraded being because they're not suppressive people. I'm not going to re-explain stuff I've already explained in earlier videos on this because I've already covered this extensively. What is a suppressive person? What is a potential trouble source or a PTS, right? Person who's connected to a suppressive person. So a degraded being is sort of a kind of special brand of a PTS individual. Here are some word-for-word definitions from Hubbard, and then I'll give some commentary on it. Degraded being. A sick Phaeton who is all caved in can't direct a postulate at anything. When he tries, he lets it wobble around and go elsewhere. The difference between a degraded being and an OT is simply that the DB can't put out a postulate or intention in a direct line or way and make it hold good. Okay, so a postulate in Scientology is a directed or intended thought or effort to make something happen. And in Scientology, postulates are a big deal. When you make a postulate, you are basically putting out positive thought in a direction that makes something happen. When you have a sick Phaeton who's all screwed up, he can't do this. He can't make things happen. He's unable. He's disabled as a being, okay? And that means that they're really screwed up, and good luck with getting them to ever rise to the occasion, pick themselves up by their bootstraps, you know, that sort of thing, just sort of the sick little guy. One imagines a homeless person down in his luck, down in the dumps, can't even barely move, you know, this kind of really trashed individual. Two, a harsh term, but a true one. It means a person who is at effect to such degree that he or she avoids orders or instructions in any possible covert or overt way because orders of any kind are confused with painful indoctrinations in the past. This person cannot be at cause without attaining OT level 3. Therefore, they prevent the org from being at cause as they cannot be at cause themselves and will not let the org or anything else be at cause, including executives. Okay, so a little commentary on this because it's sort of a self-contradictory definition if you think about it. Here, Hubbard is saying that these guys, these sick, degraded, you know, messed up guys, have been so messed up by the whole OT3 Zimu thing that they're just screwed. But yet there they are running a body in front of you and they go through life, but they just don't really get much of anything done. And they're kind of, and you know, if for anybody, any literary people out there, you know, Bartleby Scrivener, right? The Herman Melville story about the guy who just sits there and scribes all day, and every time the boss comes over and asks him to do anything, he looks up and goes, "I would prefer not to," and goes back to writing. You know, the guy just doesn't do anything, and eventually in the story, he just sort of, you know, dies penniless, you know, just crawls, sits down on the steps of the courthouse or something and dies, if I remember the end of the story right. That would be a real exemplary, you know, example of a degraded being. It's just a messed up, screwed up guy. But the reason I said that there was some self-contradiction going on in there is he says in the definition that they cannot be at cause themselves and will not let the org or anything else be at cause. Well, if they're so not at cause, how are they possibly going to get in the way of anybody else being cause? Like what, throw their body in front of people? I mean, come on. Hubbard says that people who leave the Sea Org are degraded beings, right? Really, what this was is just another control mechanism of Hubbard's where, you know, he was down on people who wouldn't follow orders. If somebody wouldn't do what he said to do, he'd come up with some label to slap on them that would make them feel bad and horrible and awful. And introvert, this was really important. This was big in Hubbard's tool chest, right? And toolkit is that he would not only, you know, kick you out or degrade you in some way, but, you know, that it made it so that all the attention from you went inward on what a horrible, awful person you were and how it was really all your fault in the end. And this was pretty evil stuff. And this is what this degraded being label is all about, is slapping a label on someone and saying they're so screwed up that they're incapable of really making anything happen in their lives and are just getting in everybody else's way all the time, every time, 24/7, and just get out of here, right? And that was how Hubbard treated people that he didn't like or that he thought crossed his path or got in his way somehow. So that's really what the degraded being thing is. But I thought I'd give it to you in his own words so you could see, you know, how the mind screwery sort of works in Scientology with that. Kelly McMorris. Hi, Chris. How do Scientologists rationalize the fact that they claim not to worship or deify LRH, but also keep offices for him ready for his posthumous return? Well, actually, it's pretty easy explaining this because it's not really in the world of Scientology at the public level and the staff level especially, it's not really literally thought by these people that Hubbard is coming back someday, any day now, and they better have an office ready for him. That's not really how they think. I mean, some of them might think that, but that's not really what that's about. What it is it's sort of a tradition. And it serves, the office serves in the organizations as a kind of acknowledgement to Hubbard. And it keeps there, and this is according to Hubbard's own policies, right? So somebody would have to go in and change a lot of Hubbard policies in order to do away with the L. Ron Hubbard offices in each of the organizations. Because Hubbard makes it very clear in his policies that that is to exist. And there's a whole checklist of what's to be in there, and it's supposed to be cleaned every few days, right? It's not supposed to be any dust in there and that sort of thing. And these offices are treated with a certain degree of reverence, for sure. But it's not a deification so much as it's just an acknowledgement from Scientologists that they acknowledge that this guy, Hubbard, was a great, great guy, and they all look up to him, and they think he's a, you know, super genius. And so they keep this office for him in a traditional sense. That's really what it comes down to. It's not a worship thing in the sense of, say, the way that, you know, Jesus Christ is deified and worshiped. So, that's really the best way I can put it. Kiva Go. Do you think it's a good thing or a mistake that the upcoming 2017 Stargate sequel movie will be ignoring all the series and TV movies that came after the first movie? I look forward to your review when it comes out. Yeah, no, I don't think it's a mistake because I never liked the TV show. I thought they were shit. I liked the movie. In fact, last night the movie was on, and I was actually watching it again. And you know, it's corny. It's a total popcorn thriller and action ride, and there's all kinds of bad science and everything in it. It's a Roland Emmerich, you know, Independence Day sort of spirited movie. Made by Carol Co back in the Mario Kasar days, right? These are the guys who, you know, brought you the Schwarzenegger, a lot of Schwarzenegger movies and that sort of thing, like Total Recall. So it's kind of in that sort of tradition. But James Spader and Kurt Russell did a fantastic job, didn't really bring a lot of corn into the movie in their roles. They really took it seriously, and so it made it a cut above a lot of other movies that were made by that production company. And I had a great time with Stargate, and I always loved it. And I always look back on it with fond memories. And seeing it again also, you know, brought some of those memories to mind, and I enjoyed what I saw, and I thought it was good stuff. The TV show, you know, and the movies and stuff on TV, I could never go there with that stuff. I always thought, you know, when you make stuff like that into a TV show, you lose a lot of the spirit of the movie and the specialness of it and stuff. And you, of course, the budget's never as good and that sort of thing too. So I have no problem just dumping all of that and just going movie to movie. I'm down. And it's flash answer time. Stephen Willis, Ford or GM? I have to know, LOL. This debate has been so successfully exported from the USA to Australia that I bet if I put Ford as my religion on my census paper or a birth certificate application, it'd be accepted. Okay, well, I don't even know how there's a debate because clearly Ford, I mean, Mustangs, hello? Like, I don't know any other car. There's one other car. There's a Dodge Charger that I just love. Love those cars, most of my love for those cars goes back to Mad Max, because that's the car, the Dodge Charger, looks most like the Ford car that was Australia made only, that Mad Max used in the first Mad Max movie and then the Road Warrior. That's my dream car. I love that car. Always have. Big blower on the front, and that was a badass car. I wanted that thing from the first time I, you know, ever thought about owning a car. And if I ever become rich and famous, I'm gonna figure out how to get one of those things. So for me, there's no question, Ford all the way. J-Magin JHF. I remember on the list of original LRHEDs, one entitled John Travolta, but it wasn't included in the pack. Have you ever heard of a one-copy-only LRHED? Carry on, my friend. LRHEDs are L. Ron Hubbard Executive Directives, and they were issues that Hubbard put out of blue ink on white paper, which were only supposed to be good for 1 year, and they were directives that he issued, often for certain areas or specific subjects, although there were many LRHEDs that covered the, you know, situations over the entire world. And they had a lot of good news in them, or, you know, various programs to get done in the various organizations around the world. The LRHED called John Travolta was a confidential reference. And so he issued as an LRHED. In it were a list of people that were supposed to be the ones who were tasked with dealing with John Travolta and trusted to deal with him. And that's, I never actually saw the issue itself, but I knew somebody who was on that list. And so that's how I know about that issue. So yes, there were LRHEDs that were written that were one-offs that were meant for very specific zones or areas. S.P. Sheeds, what did you and the other people inside of the Church of Scientology think of the horrific music and shows during your events? I think I've seen less cheese at a Green Bay Packers game. Horrific. Thanks for your info. They're quite interesting to watch. Okay, I hope I got your name right there. Yeah, we didn't really like them much either. I mean, you know, when you're in there and that's all you got, you go with it, right? And, you know, the Golden Era musicians and stuff were never my idea of the epitome of a good rollicking time with music. I mentioned before, I'm not really into jazz. They did a lot of jazzy kind of stuff. But anyway, as far as the shows and the singers and whatnot, you know, it was what we had. That's about all I can say about it. But a lot of us were not really that into it. Okay, and so we've reached the end of another episode. Please leave any comments, feedback, good, bad, indifferent, anything like that, and your questions. Fire more away at me. I am more than happy to answer anything and everything on this show that I can. You know, I try to keep it to things that I actually know about for the most part. And I've been asked questions, just so you guys know, that I don't have a clue about. You know, I don't know how to answer them because I just don't know. And maybe at some point I should, you know, just sort of say that, you know, so you're not leaving you in mystery. But a lot of these questions that I've been asked from months and months past that I've never brought up, that's why. So I don't know what to say to them. But sometimes I do some research on them and, you know, and sometimes not. So anyway, fire away, and I look forward to getting them, and thanks for coming around. I'll see you guys next week.